Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week, we're going to investigate the potential of far ultraviolet light for fighting the next viral pandemic. We're also going to look at the plausibility of the science in the Chinese sci-fi blockbuster film Wandering Earth. And we're going to talk about the latest developments in the search for the mysterious Planet Nine. Teledyne Hastings Instruments is proud to sponsor this podcast from Physics World. For over 75 years, Teledyne Hastings has provided reliable vacuum gauging and precision mass flow controllers and meters. We were trusted to help bring home the moon rocks. Let us help you with your toughest vacuum and flow applications. Visit us at teledyne-hi.com. Now, it's well known that ultraviolet light is harmful to living organisms. That's why we put on sunscreen, after all. However, the Australian physicist Charlie Ironside argues that a specific part of the ultraviolet spectrum could be very useful in the fight against infectious diseases, because this light destroys viruses while being relatively harmless to humans. I'm joined by the freelance journalist and regular Physics World contributor, John Cartwright, to talk about this idea. Hi, John.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, I'm right in saying that UV is really dangerous to the human body. That's right, isn't it, John?
Yeah, I think we all know that one of the reasons you don't go out in the sun for too long without protection is because of the UV rays in sunlight. It's known to damage DNA, and of course, with the damage to DNA, there's the risk of cancer as well, and that's the reason we avoid it.
And that, of course, applies to us, but it also applies to things like bacteria, for example. And I think UV is used. I mean, it's used in hospitals, and I think it's even used to sterilize buses in China. So UV does have medical applications. But so how does that work if the radiation is actually dangerous?
As you say, yes, the UV is used to irradiate hospital settings and things that come into contact with people to kill the bacteria and viruses that are present. It works because usually there aren't people there at all. They turn these lights on when there isn't anyone there, or if there is someone there, then those people would have to be wearing suitably protective clothing that's proven to block out those UV rays.
And so in general, UV is a bad thing. But Charlie Ironside points out that there is some UV light that is it relatively safe for people? This is this far UV radiation.
Mm. So Charlie Ironside, he's a physicist who specializes in LEDs at Curtin University in Perth in Australia. And actually, he's really drawing attention to the research of, I suppose you'd call him a medical physicist, called David Brenner at Columbia University in New York. And Brenner's done some experiments to demonstrate that actually a small band of UV radiation does appear to be safe for skin, while still being dangerous to bacteria and viruses. So this is a range of UV in what we call the UVC band. This far UVC band is around 222 nanometers. And what Brenner's found is that if he exposed mice to those wavelengths of UVC light, then they didn't actually get any evidence of skin damage, whereas the same, precisely the same wavelength of UVC light was in fact effective at killing a certain bacteria. I think in this case it was MRSA. And there's been some subsequent research as well to show that that particular band of UVC is dangerous to viruses as well. So it's quite interesting, the idea that actually UV in general is quite dangerous, but there could be this small band that is relatively safe for humans, but still dangerous to viruses and bacteria.
But I think there's a catch here, because am I right in thinking that it's at the moment it's actually fairly difficult to produce this light, in a sort of a practical way?
Yeah, so the UV light that is currently used in, as you mentioned, hospitals, or in China they've got it to irradiate buses, that's produced by essentially fluorescent tubes, and that's at a wavelength around 250 nanometers, which is still dangerous to humans. You can produce far UVC light at this special 222 nanometer wavelength. And to do that, you need a fairly special type of lamp. But it's a bit similar to a fluorescent lamp, but it's still very delicate, and it's not the sort of thing that any old person could just have, lying around the house to use whenever they felt like it. So. So the idea is that if you could develop LEDs that emit at this wavelength, then, well, you'd have something that is far more practicable to irradiate things with, that sort of anyone could use, not just sort of specialists in hospitals.
And so that's where Charlie Ironside comes in, I'm guessing, because I think you mentioned that he was interested in LEDs. He does research on LEDs. So does he have a plan to produce LEDs that can create this radiation in a practical way?
Yeah, so he told me he's actually an infrared LED specialist, but he is going to start looking at far UVC LEDs. There's some challenges involved in creating LEDs at that wavelength that I think everyone will have to overcome. But I think what Ironside really wanted to sort of promote is that, there's now obviously a very good reason for doing so. When we think of the sheer economic impact and the psychological impact as well of lockdowns, if you could create devices, LED devices that operate at that wavelength, then, well, there'd certainly be a big market for them.
And what's the state of the art at the moment? I mean, can they actually produce this radiation, and can they produce enough of it, or are the current devices very dim?
Yeah, so they can. You can produce LEDs at this wavelength. The trouble with the existing devices is that these are kind of lab prototypes, and the efficiency of them is really low. It's too low, really, to have those prototypes commercialized. So there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done, particularly on the composition of the LEDs, which is what really determines the wavelengths of light that are generated.
So it sounds like a lot more work needs to be done. And I suppose, like a lot of scientific innovations that we've been hearing about during the pandemic, it might be a good idea for the future, but it's not going to help us right now.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, obviously, these things take time. Although I was speaking to one physicist at Glasgow University, and essentially, the first he had heard of this idea was when I sent him an email a couple of days before talking with him. And then when I did come to talk with him, he was already essentially drafting out a grant proposal. People can move quickly, and particularly now there's a lot of research funding. Anything that is relevant to COVID-19 is likely to be fast-tracked. And there's funding out there for obvious reasons. In fact, just before coming to speak with you now, Hamish, I just got an email from another researcher who works for a small startup company producing LEDs, and he said they're now going to look at these far UVC LEDs too. So it's sort of already getting some traction, which is quite interesting.
Well, that's great. Yeah, and it sounds like you've done your little bit as well to get things moving.
That's, well, we'll see. I mean, we'll keep our fingers crossed, won't we?
That's fantastic. And so John has written a feature article about the possibility of using this UV light to battle against viruses. And you can read the article on the Physics World website. It's called "The Potential of Far Ultraviolet Light for the Next Pandemic." Thanks, John, for joining us on the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Thanks, Hamish.
As a physicist, I have a love-hate relationship with science fiction films. I love the big concepts and a good rip-roaring story. But I often find myself scratching my head or even shouting at the screen when science, and particularly physics, is portrayed poorly. Sometimes I prefer it when writers and directors just make things up, rather than trying to shoehorn a genuine scientific concept into the action. I'm joined by my Physics World colleague Tushna Commissariat, who is a big sci-fi fan, to talk about the physics in the blockbuster Chinese sci-fi film Wandering Earth. Hi, Tushna.
Hi, Hamish.
So, Tushna, do you find yourself shouting at the screen sometimes when science is portrayed in a particularly bad way? Or are you pretty easy with that?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think I couldn't agree with you more with what you just said in the introduction. That's absolutely how I feel about science fiction too, even though I really enjoy it. And I'm happy to set aside a lot towards sort of literary license. There's sometimes where, especially like you mentioned, when they really try to shoehorn the physics in and they try to make it seem really accurate, but it's all wrong. That's when I get really upset. And regular readers of Physics World's review section would know that I really didn't enjoy last year's blockbuster sci-fi film Ad Astra. It just didn't do anything for me, even though people sort of loved it and think it's very beautiful and eloquent. I thought it was boring, and a lot of the scientific concepts were just so wrong. So yeah, but like you said, I do really enjoy the sort of grand plots and schemes, and I enjoy the fun aspects of it too, for sure. So it's definitely a tale of two halves for me.
So Wandering Earth, as well as being a blockbuster, I think that this is significant because it's one of the first Chinese blockbusters, you know, sort of worldwide. So tell us a bit more about this film, Wandering Earth.
So yeah, the film, it grossed something like 700 million worldwide. It's China's third highest grossing film of all time and the third highest grossing non-English film to date. So it's pretty big. For those who just like to watch it, if you have a Netflix account, then I think pretty much everywhere in the world, it's now available to watch on Netflix. So, you know, once you listen to the podcast, if you're tempted, then you can go check it out on Netflix. So the concept of the film, it's pretty fun. It's pretty crazy and out there. The Wandering Earth, the title, gives you a little bit of a hint. So the idea is...
So the Earth is wandering.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's wandering or more like it's being dragged someplace different. But the basic plot of it is that far into the future, because of a certain stage in our sun going, turning into a red giant and swallowing the Earth, instead of moving humanity to another planet, the idea here is that we move the entire planet. And they're not...
Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, why not? You know, you could do the one, move the people, or two, just, you know, take the home with us. and the idea here, to make it even crazier, is that we're not just moving the Earth out of the sun's reach, or sort of, you know, hopping in behind Jupiter and Saturn or something like that. We're taking it about 4.2 light years away to our next nearest sort of stellar system, which is Alpha Centauri. So we're going on a 2,500 year journey into interstellar space, and we're moving the whole planet there. So that's the basic plot. Who wouldn't want to watch that?
Hold on. And, you know, here I am with my, you know, sort of grumpy physicist hat on. Why not just move Earth a bit further away from the sun? I mean, surely there would be, wouldn't there be a sort of habitable zone a bit further away? Why would you have to go all the way to a new star?
You've hit the nail on the head there, Hamish. That's absolutely a very good point, that if you were really going to move the Earth, as it turns out, to really escape the worst of the sun's effects, you'd have to really push the Earth no further than about 0.5 of an AU away from where it currently stands. So we're at 1 AU.
Astronomical unit, is it?
Sorry, that's right. So one astronomical, you know, we calculate that based on our distance from the sun. So one astronomical unit away from the sun, and all we have to get to is 1.5, which incidentally is where Mars currently is located. So, you know, option one, hop onto Mars. Option two, move the Earth onto a similar orbit as Mars. And as you kind of, you know, you mentioned habitable zones there. And the interesting thing is that when the sun does expand and go into its red giant phase, the actual habitable zone will expand greatly, and it will end up actually covering a lot of the objects in the Kuiper belt. So a lot of those icy bodies that are currently completely frozen solid will suddenly have free flowing water on them. So there's plenty of options within our solar system. But, you know, I think maybe just for fun, the director here. So I should mention that The Wandering Earth is loosely based on a book, a novella by the same title, by a very popular Chinese sci-fi author, Liu Cixin. I'm probably completely mangling his name there, but he's the author of Three Body Problem, which we've reviewed and was very popular Chinese sci-fi book series. And so, yeah, Wandering Earth is one of his other books. I say that I haven't read the book, but Wikipedia very kindly told me that the film and the book really do diverge. But this idea of moving the Earth to Alpha Centauri is the same in both the film and the book. But the film uses it in quite different ways, and the book kind of uses it almost more as a discussion point of, was this a sensible idea? Should we have done this? Or was it like an overreaction or a bad idea? Which the film doesn't really get into. The film is a lot more action and thriller, and it follows some, so not only, so we kind of set off, we get into the Earth's journey where we're kind of coming into the bit where it's going past Jupiter. And in the film, that's when...
And that's an important bit, isn't
it?
It was the plan to sort of use Jupiter as a sort of gravitational slingshot to send Earth on its way to another star. Was that the idea of the Jupiter encounter? Because I would have thought you'd want to avoid Jupiter if you could.
Absolutely. Again, you've got it in one there, Hamish. In the film, and potentially in the book too, they you know, a lot of the spacecrafts that traverse our solar system use this method of a slingshot. You use a gravitational slingshot, you spin around a particular planet or moon a couple of times, and you use the gravitational potential to get enough energy to slingshot your way to wherever you're going. And like you mentioned, it's probably quite dangerous to do that using Jupiter, considering its size. But also I could see why it would give you this the sort of kick you'd need, because of course you're trying to get a mass that's as big as the Earth to achieve an escape velocity where it can pull away from, you know, the gravitational pull of the sun. So you're trying to achieve something like 42 kilometers a second. So yes, the idea is to use Jupiter as a slingshot. But then, as you can imagine, it all goes horribly wrong because all of a sudden there's a gravitational kick in Jupiter. No explanation whatsoever of why the gravity of Jupiter suddenly changes.
So the physics is a bit dodgy there then,
yes,
you would say.
Absolutely. That was one of the kind of worst bits. You thinking that they would have worked out the mathematics of this pass from Jupiter really carefully, and then it all goes wrong so early on in the journey, and we nearly get swallowed and destroyed by Jupiter. And in the end, spoilers, to sort of get away from Jupiter and get enough energy to escape Jupiter pulling the Earth into itself, they end up exploding Jupiter using the sort of massive blast to shoot off, which again, wow. No, as you can imagine, lots of issues there. Not only to mention, I don't think it's possible to very easily ignite Jupiter, which.
And what about the physics of the sun, the solar physics? Did that? I mean, was the, you know, the sun's progression to a red giant, was that something that sort of occurred, you know, as in the main sequence of stars, or was that, why did the sudden did it suddenly become a red giant? Was this a surprise? Or?
Yeah. So it's all very hand wavy and very quick in the initial part of the film when they try and do an explanation. So the film starts with they've already started this wandering Earth thing, and it's from the point of view of someone who's almost entirely grown up underground because we started moving the Earth already. And what they explain is, so the film is set in the future, but it's definitely not far enough into the future to when we know our sun will be approaching the end stages of its life. And as you mentioned, leaving the main sequence when it's no longer a main sequence star and starts expanding into a red giant. So that's about 1.5 billion years from now. And so the film definitely isn't set that far into the future. And obviously that's one of those things that I don't know if we really need to worry about that, because the idea of humanity surviving on Earth for another 1.5 billion years is looking pretty stark, especially right now. So they definitely don't set it that far. And what the thing that they keep mentioning in the beginning, and the reason why they feel like they have to move the entire Earth, is this thing called a helium flash. That's what they kind of say, that, oh, there's this upcoming helium flash and that's going to destroy everything. And so we need to get out before this happens. And a helium flash.
So that's in the sun, a helium flash in the sun.
Yes, indeed. And now it is a thing, all right? So a helium flash is this very short thing that can happen. It's basically thermal runaway nuclear fusion, where what happens is a very large quantity of helium is turned into carbon, because, you know, through the triple alpha process. And it can only happen in quite low mass stars when they're already in their red giant phase, because they run out of they run out of hydrogen. And so they kind of start eating up their helium to be able to collapse in on themselves, because there just isn't enough gravitational pressure to kick off the usual helium fusion. So it kind of cannibalizes itself. So again, that helium flash happens. But as I just mentioned, funnily enough, the helium flash can only happen when it's already a red giant. So you can't a helium flash as a precursor to the red giant. And then, you know, again, as and when the sun sort of starts down its red giant phase, it will already be getting so hot for so many millennia before it really gets in. You know, these things don't sort of happen overnight. And so it'll already be too late for the Earth, that, you know, the temperatures will have been rising for so many millennia that all the oceans would have been evaporated and things like that. So we can't hang around even to the sort of precursor of the sun really going into its red giant phase. And then this helium flash would really happen afterwards. Interestingly enough, in the book, apparently it deals with a lot of these sort of doubts that people have. So there's two two parties set much further along into this 2,500-year journey. And one party believes that this whole helium flash thing, it probably didn't happen and it wasn't a good enough reason to push the whole Earth out. So I think in the book he deals with a lot more of the sort of politics and the philosophies of doing something as crazy as this. And, you know, that's about 250 generations would be living on in the Earth through this process. So you can imagine.
So a long time then.
That's okay. Right.
So the solar physics, a bit dodgy. What about the physics of this amazing propulsion system that's been used to sort of push Earth out of its orbit? Is that, did that seem plausible?
I'm afraid not. So the idea was, I'll tell you what though, it made for some unbelievably amazing imagery, right? So the Earth just suddenly starts looking like this massive giant comet. So the idea is that they build 12,000 fusion engines a lot on one side of the Earth so you can propel it. You know, you have, like any engine, you have it on one end. So one entire side of the Earth is covered in these 12,000 engines. And the idea here is that for fuel, they mine the Earth itself. And that there is one of the key points where their science falls, because if you were building that many engines and you were trying to accelerate a mass, this mass of the Earth, for a 2,500-year period, essentially, there was an NASA physicist who did the maths and worked out that you'd almost completely cannibalize the entire Earth. You would have to use the entire Earth as fuel. You'd be left with something approaching 3% of the Earth's mass by the time you reached Alpha Centauri. So that feels like a key flaw where by the time you got there, you're you know, approaching something the size of a small asteroid instead of our, you know, heartily sized planet. And then there's other issues also about things like, you know, they actually address that there's a period of acceleration and then there's a braking phase where, you know, essentially you stay still, but what you're really doing is slowing down. And then they say, you know, you obviously have to decelerate as you approach wherever it is you're reaching, which is, you know, what a lot of the spacecraft that we have today do. But again, I was quite confused. So as to how, if you had all of these, you know, half the Earth covered in these, how exactly you would decelerate, how the engines would be suddenly going in the other direction, or you potentially do it only on like half of the Earth, of half of those half engines, and then you kind of try and maneuver a rotation. Yeah, I'm not quite sure how it would work. So,
I mean, it does. It is an interesting problem, isn't it? You know, it's a sort of problem that you could pose somebody in a, you know, sort of an oral exam or something, and say, you know, the sun is about to expand, you know, to this size. You know, what, given the laws of physics, should people on the Earth do? And do you think that that your average physics student would propose blasting off to another star? Or, I mean, it sounds like there might be better ways to use physics to solve this conundrum.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I joked about this earlier, saying that it's a little bit like, you know, you're entering the realm of a spherical cow in a vacuum. You know, the physics of it does work. You can do it. You're not technically breaking any laws of physics, but it's the worst possible idea to solve this problem in reality. And just like the spherical cow in a vacuum won't be very happy, neither will the Earth. And so, but it's like taking a problem and trying to come up with the most extreme solution while still vaguely adhering to the laws of physics. And so it is, it's a thought problem, isn't it? It's a bit of a Gedanken, I think. And it could, I mean, you know what? It would have interested me a lot more at uni if I was solving a problem like that rather than a more typical celestial dynamics problem, I'm sure I'd be much more entertained if I was trying to figure out if you could jettison the entire Earth to Alpha Centauri.
There's much more from Tushna on Wandering Earth in the podcast The Cosmic Shed, which is hosted by Andrew Glester. And Andrew also hosts the Physics World Stories podcast, which comes out monthly on the Physics World website. And Tushna, I sort of like to think of The Cosmic Shed as a complementary podcast to the Physics World podcast, because in The Cosmic Shed, you look both at science fact and science fiction. It's a really interesting program, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoy it. It, you know, lets me talk about physics and science, but also have fun talking about all of the fiction. So yeah, we definitely like to think of it as a sister podcast. And I'm sure that many of our listeners who might enjoy our podcast might enjoy The Cosmic Shed and vice versa. So check it out. Talking about fiction, Hamish, I noticed that you have a new story on the website that seems a bit more science fiction than fact.
Well, I can assure you, Tushna, that there are some facts involved in this story. But yeah, it is really interesting. This is an article that describes two proposals for working out whether there is a primordial black hole in the solar system.
Wow. Where did that idea come from?
Well, if you look at the orbits of large objects in the Kuiper Belt, that's the region of the solar system beyond Neptune. It looks like they're being influenced gravitationally by an invisible object that's several times more massive than Earth. This mysterious object would be about 500 Earth orbits from the Sun, and it's been dubbed Planet Nine.
Okay, so a planet sounds pretty reasonable. I can get behind that, but where does a black hole come in?
Well, the problem is that astronomers have not been able to observe Planet Nine. Now, that's not surprising, considering how far away it's expected to be. So in principle, I suppose that leaves the field open, and it could be a primordial black hole rather than a planet. Now, a primordial black hole is a small black hole, maybe about the size of an apple, that could have been created just after the Big Bang.
Oh, wow. So how exactly would you go around detecting an apple-sized black hole, Hamish?
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, detecting a planet that's much bigger than Earth is difficult. Yeah, how would you detect an apple-sized black hole? So this news article covers two proposals, and both of these proposals, now this is sounding a bit like Wandering Earth, involve using a giant laser on Earth to sort of accelerate a swarm of tiny spacecraft towards where Planet Nine, or indeed this black hole, is thought to be. One proposal is from the eminent theoretical physicist Edward Witten, and it involves having each spaceship sending a time signal back to Earth. The idea is if these spacecraft get close to the black hole, they'll be accelerated by its gravity, and the time signal should change.
Wow, okay, so we have some like nice relativistic dynamics coming into play. And so what's the other idea? Does it also involve giant lasers, like you mentioned?
Oh yeah, it involves giant lasers, but it's a bit simpler. Instead of having the spacecraft send back timing signals, which could be very difficult because that would require onboard atomic clocks to get the right accuracy, Scott Lawrence and Zeev Rogozinski plan to measure the gravitational deflection of this swarm of spacecraft using long baseline interferometry. Now, that's an existing technique that is used by radio astronomers.
Wow, so definitely more fact than fiction there, Hamish.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely lots of facts here. But I suppose the big question is that could you talk NASA or indeed the Chinese Space Agency into funding these missions? So, I mean, I think it's pretty unlikely that they will go ahead, you know, unless we see some more real evidence that that Planet Nine is a primordial black hole. And, you know, just thinking about it, Planet Nine sounds like a great topic for a future Physics World Stories podcast. Perhaps you could pass this news article on to Andrew.
That sounds like a great idea, Hamish. I think Andrew would enjoy it greatly too. So, yeah, you know, look out for the Physics World Stories podcast sometime in the future.
Good stuff. And in the meantime, you can read about these two proposals on the Physics World website in an article called If Planet Nine is a Primordial Black Hole, Could We Detect It with a Tiny Fleet of Spacecraft? Oh. Sorry, that's not a tiny fleet of spacecraft. It's a fleet of tiny spacecraft.
Sorry. Just imagining a tiny fleet now. Oh, dear.
Okay. A fleet of tiny, that's right.
Yeah.
Detect it with a fleet of tiny spacecraft. And that article is by one of our regular contributors, Merrick Stevens. Okay, thanks, Tushna. Thanks for being on this episode of the Physics World Weekly podcast.
My pleasure, Hamish.
That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Tushna Commissariat and John Cartwright for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. This podcast was brought to you by Teledyne Hastings Instruments. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.